All right, I think we're ready to start talking.
Okay.
You don't do a lot of sitting around. I guess you continue a relatively busy work schedule for yourself, huh? Keep turning them out.
Well, it's 2 years, but I've done a couple of novellas and some film treatments and whatever. So I always, I'm a writer. You know, people congratulate me that for going back to work. And I say, do you congratulate, you know, you're starting another book. Aren't you going to give yourself a year off? And I always say, listen, do you congratulate the guy who goes back to the George Washington Bridge to take tolls on Monday? This is my job. This is what I do for a living. This is what I love to do.
You don't want people saying, Mary Higgins Clark, she used to be a writer.
Yeah, what is she doing now? Has anyone heard from her? Did I hear she retired to Florida? No way.
What do you do with novellas? Where do you sell those?
Well, there's one right now out in Women's Day, a two-part. And the one that I'm doing for a mini-series that I'll do the novella just out of love, but it'll probably go somewhere. And I had a short story, two short stories out this year in magazines, one in Ladies' Home Journal and one in Women's Day. So it's fun because there are often times when the idea is not big enough for a book, but it's right for a short story. And, of course, that's how I began this crazy writing career, as a short story writer.
Well, pretty soon you're going to have to collect all your short stories and novellas into a book, aren't you?
Well, eventually I would like to do that. Yeah, I thought if I do three novellas, that would make a book. You know how you count the number of pages, or when you were a kid and you did the composition and you figured the more pages you wrote, the more the teacher would be impressed. So three novellas would make be the equivalent of one book.
You'd have a Mary Higgins Clark reader.
I hope so. Replacing, what was the early one, Don? The very early reader the kids used to have in the log cabin. That's it.
McGuffey? Yeah. Readers? McGuffey was first president of my alma mater, Ohio University, by the way.
Oh, really?
I still have a hall named for McGuffey.
I love
McGuffey
it.
Hall.
McGuffey Hall, okay.
Surprise, surprise. But you thought they were going to name it Putnam Hall or something like that. Well, tell me about Weep No More, My Lady. And you have a lot of interesting elements in there, the health spa, you dabble with high society and all that stuff. Tell me about this book and how this came about.
Well, I always look ahead 2 years to see what will people be interested in reading about when the book comes out, figuring the time to read it, the time, you know, that it goes into production. And if you notice, everybody is into health and beauty, aerobics, running, jogging, eating better, all the rest of it. And I thought, I'd like to set a book in a spa because there's sort of a glamour attached to it. But now spas is springing up all over the country. You know, you used to have the golden door. Now you have the wooden door for budget price spas. And when you think about the fact that the Europeans have been going to spas for 1,000 years, right? I just did something on the Civil War in England, and in the middle of the Civil War, Charles I was pleased to go to the spa and get rid of his stress. So I thought, I'm going to try using the spa as a background. And I went to 3 different spas to do my research, which is heavenly research, incidentally, and then I created my own.
Yeah, that was a tough assignment.
Oh, yes, wasn't it, though? It was really evil.
Tell me, when you write a mystery, isn't it almost inevitable that there has to be a murder? Isn't it? Doesn't it go hand in hand?
Well, you see, the first star of any book is the victim. Why was he or she murdered? What effect does it have on other people? Why did someone love her or hate her so much, or both, that he was obsessed by her? So to start with a murder, I mean, if you start by robbing a candy store and going away with 3 lollipops, you don't have a very important book, right? Unless the last lollipop was gone and some kid wanted it. But you take murder, and it is the ultimate crime. The deprivation of life is the ultimate crime.
Such a perverse crime. You wonder why we have so much fun with it.
Well, because there is so much violence in this world that I think when we write mysteries and suspense, what we do is restore order. Violence occurs. Justice is upset. The world is in shambles. But by the end of the book, the scales of justice have triumphed. The villain has been unmasked. The victim atoned. And there's a certain catharsis to it.
You know, I think you're right. I think murder mysteries always have generally a satisfactory ending, don't they?
Generally speaking, they have a satisfactory ending where someone pays for taking human life or for committing the crime that is reprehensible.
So that's why we like murder mysteries so much. Yeah?
Well, you know, when you start with the book of Genesis, Eve convinced Adam to commit a felony, to steal or eat the apple, right? That was forbidden. They left and they had two children and one killed the other. So from earliest of man, the family has been involved in murder, right? Somebody said, when I said that at a seminar, we thank Mary Clark for explaining the book of Genesis.
You are still president of the American Mystery Writers Group, aren't you?
Of the Mystery Writers of America, yes.
Tell me about that. What are your duties when you...
we started like 43 years ago, and the reason was that mystery writers, mystery writing at that time, was not considered so respectable. You know what I mean? There was a sort of put-down about it, except for the really great ones. And they banded together to start a Mystery Writers of America. Now we have over 1,000 members. We have a monthly newsletter magazine that tells what's going on in the field and who's doing what. We give Edgars at a banquet every year here in New York. And those Edgars are our Oscars, our Tonys, our Andys. And they say, you are the best in our field. And mystery writing now, when you look at the bestseller list, half of the books have to do with mystery.
Let me guess where the name Edgar comes from.
Okay.
Edgar Bergen.
No, Charlie McCarthy's daddy. Mortimer Sterns fella.
I know it's got to be Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe.
Now, are there any benefits to the American Mystery Writers Association? For example, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, things like that?
We have it available. A lot of people have it. There is a medical plan that is available to writers if they want it. There is a loan fund that is available if people need help. But I think the chief support that the organization offers is you need to be with other writers. You need to know what's going on in your field. For every writer who goes off in the country and writes the bestseller, many more of us need to be with each other and find out. An editor comes and speaks at the dinner, either here or in Chicago or in California or wherever, and says, look, we have a new line. This is what we want. This is how long the length. And I know in Minneapolis a few years ago, a young guy who wanted to be a writer said, I just have to be a writer, and I want to be a mystery writer. I said, come to the MWA dinner. There are 3 days of activities surrounding it. He's written 5 books and published them. He met an agent there. He met an editor there. He gave an outline. And he's got 5 books now, and he's doing very, very well.
But it seems to me, Mary, that writers are essentially self-employed business people, aren't they? Many of them. Now, I know some of them have, well, for example, you were in advertising, so you would write in the morning on your way into work.
Right.
But many writers are, in effect, self-employed, and it would seem to me having access to hospitalization would be extremely valuable to them.
Well, many of them do it because we're also involved with the Council of Writers, the Mystery Writers of America, and that's a group where we want to offer the best insurance to everyone in the field. And also we go down and we lobby against things like writers for hire. That's a dangerous precedent that's starting. The other business that's very important that we're lobbying on is too many people have written one book and got $1,500 or $2,000, and that book is taken out over and over and over in the libraries. In England now, they pay royalties to writers. Not much, but like ASCAP pays to the songwriters, we are lobbying to get writers payment, and there is a cap on it, so nobody's going to make millions of dollars. But there are older writers whose book is enjoyed year in and year out by thousands of people, and they can barely, they're living on Social Security. And we don't think that it's fair for the writer to subsidize, in effect, the library.
What's this writers for hire business?
Well, writers for hire is where the publisher may just buy the story and no rights to the writer at all afterwards, you see. Most of us sell our North American rights or our North American rights and our film rights and share it with the publisher and retain our foreign rights. You might retain the television rights. But the writers for hire ends up in an absolute buyout. And we don't think it's a good practice, and it's a practice that is spreading. And you see, the hardest part is for young writers, let's face it, it's so hard to get published that you'll almost sign any contract in the world just to get started. And we have a model contract and say, look, you don't have to give away these rights. Retain them. You'll be awfully sorry if you give away these rights. And it's not really expected. So it's sort of an education for new writers as well, so that they get their feet planted, because it's an awfully sad thing if you sold a story for $100 and it ends up a television series and you don't have the rights to it. And there's a lot of that around from before.
But the publisher could say, well, look, you don't sign this contract, I'm not going to publish the story.
He could say it, but you see, if enough writers say, no, this really is not a fair contract, and if organizations support the fact that this ought not to be, then the publishers, I mean, I'm blessed with a wonderful publisher who gives me wonderful contracts, but there are too many people who have very bad contracts, and they come in and they find out that they've given away all the rights, and suddenly this property is making a lot of money. And that's not fair.
You would think the publisher would be on the writer's side because the publisher needs writers so badly, but yet all the time I hear writers complain about their relationship with their publishers and their editors.
Well, again, I speak from a point of someone who's been blessed with the same publisher for all my books and the same softcover publisher and very good editors. But the fact is that many publishing houses have been bought by big concerns, and the bottom line is the balance sheet. So as a result, you don't have that wonderful situation where the editor brings along, the editor has discretion to bring along a writer who he thinks in two or three books is going to do very well. He has to look always at the bottom line. And that's a problem in writing. You know, the old business of it being a nurturing profession is starting to go, and it's something that we want to keep encouraged.
Yeah, it went out with Max Perkins.
Sort of, yeah. I was just reading again his bio, you know, just touching through it because it was wonderful. And I love the line where they called him the dean of editors, and he said to his daughter very sadly, that means I'm on the skids.
Now, you're also involved in an international group of mystery writers.
Well, you see, we have an international crime congress, Don. The first one was in 1975 in England. I had sold two short stories in Suspense, and I went to that. I didn't know a soul. I just winged it. I took my chances. I had just sold Where Are the Children. And the people I became so friendly with are my big buddies, my best buddies, and that was 13 years ago. And it was 4 days in London, and Scotland Yard came over, and they did a step-by-step history of one of their famous cases. We went, they brought in dogs to show how they sniff out drugs. They put drugs around. They brought us to Scotland Yard. It was wonderful. And then we had one in 1978 in New York. It was I Love a Mystery Week, and they came from all over the world. Then we had one in Sweden in 1981, and since then there hasn't been one. So I decided a president should do something, not just to say, yes, I'm the president of the Mystery Writers, and everyone should have a project. So my project is the International Crime Congress, and we're going to have one next May. It's going to be fantastic.
How do you organize something like that? Or does every country have something in the form of a Mystery Writers Association?
Yeah, England has the Crime Writers. There's a very strong mystery suspense writers in Sweden and in France. They come, even from the Soviet Union, they're coming to it. Japan is a huge mystery field. The editors come over. Everything I write, for example, sells in Japan. In Thailand, you'd be astonished how much in Israel and just about every European country. There's an enormous field for the mystery. So the editors and the publishers come over, and the writers come over, and we are just setting up the panels. You know, you might have a panel on how to poison someone. We go down to the morgue.
Don't give too much away.
We go down to the morgue to look at weapons. I know when we went to the morgue in 1978, they were talking about the fact that they could tell a body had been moved because the blood had settled in one place. And they said, this young man did not die here. They were showing slides. Because if you'll notice the dark patch, it means he was moved after he died. And the next book I did, the guy was so careful the way he carried the girl he had killed, so her blood wouldn't move. So you do need, you get editors and agents, and they are talking about what the field wants. Who's opening a new line? How is the private eye doing? The soft private eye, the hard-nosed private eye, the woman private eye. I was on a panel in Sweden with Ruth Rendell and a couple of other writers, and big names, and one of them, Ruth Rendell, said, I think that you should not tell whether or not a man or woman wrote a book if the name were left off it. I said, I think that a woman can offer something, so it's okay to say, you know, this book was written by a woman.
Well, it seems to me that women have the crime field pretty well bottled up, don't they?
Not really. There are a lot of big women writers, but
Sayers, P.D. James, Ruth Rendell, Mary Higgins Clark, and I mean, I could fish around for a whole bunch of
Oh, sure, but you could equally offer men's names as well. It's about a 60-40, we find, in our membership. 60% men, 40% women. But certainly the women writers have done extremely well in these last 30 years, including new fields, like Sarah Paretsky is a wonderful writer. She does a private eye, a woman private eye, who's delightful and tough and resilient and all the rest. And her novels are being noticed so well.
When is the International Congress? Congress?
International Crime Congress, May 9th to May 13th.
So you've
next
got it.
Year.
Next year.
Yeah, so, but it'll come fast. We just arranged for a boat. One night we're going to have a tour, a mystery tour around the island. And that should be a fun
night.
The
old Circle Line ploy. Huh?
One of that sort of thing. Yes, indeed. That's right. And the panels are going to be absolutely terrific. I mean, really good, meaty people on the panels. So it's going to be big. And, of course, we're going to get the publishers to do things, and we'll have lunches and dinners. And the idea is to really to talk your craft. You learn so much at them. Because, you know, Don, the trouble is that your families do one of two things. They say when you start writing, and they see a rejection slip, honey, it's so difficult, it's so hard, don't break your heart. Or they say, this is absolutely wonderful. Will you tell me what's the matter, that this is not a bestseller? You know, when you're such a wonderful writer, is there a conspiracy against you? You really need to go to guys who say, my God, this book was out 12 times and it just sold. Where? Everybody has a pencil out to see where it went. Or there's a new editor over here and he wants mysteries. So everybody knows where to send it, you know?
Well, you said something interesting a moment ago when you were talking about the body being moved and the blood and this sort of thing. Credibility counts for an awful lot in mystery writing, doesn't it?
I try and I try and I try and I try to be accurate. Now, when I finished this last book, Weep No More, My Lady, I had set it in the Monterey Peninsula, and I have a gal who goes in for collagen injection, and she gets injected with poison. And I showed it to a doctor friend of mine because I had wanted to use potassium chloride because I understand that that's not used as much. And I had been told that that's okay. And he read it and he said, absolutely not. He said, you would have to give a massive doses of potassium chloride and it wouldn't react that quickly. He said, you've injected her with insulin, whether you know it or not. And I have them pounding her heart. He said, no, you compress the chest. You don't pound the heart. That's old terminology. So that's the kind of thing that you ought to do. My daughter's an assistant prosecutor. She reads anything legal. And when I had a scene with an assistant district attorney, she said, no, he wouldn't have said it this way. He would have prepared her as a witness for the trial. He would have said this question and this question and this question. So you'd really try to get the ring of truth, because I think if you're not accurate, what happens is as though you go into a model house. It's nicely furnished, but you notice the wall doesn't meet the ceiling in the corner. And you right away know the frame is poor. And you say, okay, it looks pretty, but I don't want it. I think a book is like that. If a reader reads glaring mistakes, the reader immediately doubts the plot.
Your last book was filmed on the Cape Cod, wasn't it?
Well, that was the first book. Stillwatch was the last one, and that one was filmed in Georgetown. Where Are the Children was filmed on the Cape, yeah.
That was recently, though,
Yes, a year and a half ago, yes.
And you had a role in that, didn't you?
Oh, I had a wonderful
part.
Tell me about
that.
Well, you know, I had won the Dramatic Medal from Villa Maria Academy at 16, and at 17, I won a CYO competition as Best Actress in the Bronx. So this was churning and yearning in me. I really wanted to go to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and I ended up in Wood Secretarial School. But the producer said, would you like to be in it? I said, oh, yes. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to put you right in front. And Jill Clayburgh was the actress playing Nancy, and she had just been convicted of the murder of her children. He said, you're all vultures, news people. Mrs. Clark, you get right in front. We want to really show you off. And he said, when she comes out, scream questions at her. So I'm getting the energy up and thinking, you know, this is the beginning of yet another career. And they said, all right, energy people, energy, action. Well, I ran over and I screamed, tell the truth, Jill. Did you kill your kids, Jill? Cut, cut. Who in the name of heaven called her Jill? So I don't think that I'm being rushed. I mean, I have not seen a talent agent rushing me, but maybe next time. Because we did another scene. He said, Mrs. Clark, in this scene, the character's name is Carl. I said, gotcha.
Well, do you worry about your books being filmed in the way that you approve of?
I think approve is the wrong word. You sell it to a producer, and the producer's job is to get the best possible ratings on television and tell the best story, get the best possible stars, or get the box office at the movie house. So I've always said it's as though you give up your child for adoption. If the child you would have sent to Harvard is stringing beads in Hawaii, you wish it well and you want it well. I have been generally quite satisfied. There was only one, A Stranger Is Watching, that I felt there was so much explicit violence that it spoiled the story and did not add to the tension.
Well, they changed the story, too. I mean, there was substantial, I can't remember now, but there was some, that was one with Rip Torn, right?
Yeah, I felt sorry for Rip Torn by the end of it, and he was the villain. They mugged him. I mean, he was so beat up at the end, he looked as though he needed intensive care, and he was the villain.
Well, I think they departed from the book.
I had a little five-year-old boy who was bonding to the young woman who is the heroine or protagonist, and they changed it to a 13-year-old girl. Well, she was a good actress, but you lost that little boy lost who had watched his mommy murdered, you see? And I think there was something lost in it.
So a writer gives up all of his rights?
Yeah, now the producer who's done the last two things, we've gotten to be great friends, and he'll send me the script, or he'll say, what about suggestions, or how do you like the way it's going, or what do you think? So I'm starting to get more involved, if you will. I don't want to write the screenplays. I just don't want to do that. I'd rather write another book while the screenplay is being written. But I'm getting more involved, and it is fun. You know, when they have a chair with my name. Remember Jackie Suzanne, when she went in and there was her chair? And I thought at the time I used to watch that, oh, wow, that must be very glamorous. Well, so writing, now I have my chair.
Writing the screenplay is certainly no guarantee that the motion picture is going to be filmed the way the screenplay was written.
Well, that's it. They change it. Then the director changes. Then the actor says, I think this line suits me better. So to write the screenplay and not recognize it when it's finished wouldn't intrigue me very much.
Yeah, you can hold up We No More My Lady and know that it's yours.
This is every word, every comma.
Well, your readers are certainly going to like Weep No More, My Lady, as obviously they liked your past book. So I congratulate you on this new effort, and it's always nice talking to you. I hope that I'll get an invitation to the International Crime Congress. I'd like to go to that.
Oh, absolutely. Be on a panel. Talk to us about interviewing authors.
Well, that would bore everybody silly.
It's
the author that's interesting.
I doubt it sincerely. You will come.
Mary Higgins Clark, thank you very much.
Thanks, John.